Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2012. Lecture 10, delivered on September 24, 2012. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. In fact, if I were to ask you how we measure risk, you could give me a number of different answers and they would all be correct. Risk can be measured in numerical ways. And in finance, we have several different metrics for risk. And we'll go through those in this class. And if you take further finance classes, we'll go deeper into these metrics. But there are also qualitative measures of risk, too. Have you ever been with a friend who is just a crazy mofo? And he's going to do something, and there's this little voice inside you that whispers to you, oh, hell no! There's a measure of risk. How far your hair stands up on your head. You go into a haunted house. The house says, get out! And you feel your feet just take you out of the house and move to another continent. That's a measure of risk. Okay? Risk can be measured in so many different ways. And the math of it can sometimes get a little hairy. That's why we have computers and calculators now, to make it not so intimidating that way. And some measures of risk are actually kind of, how shall I say, come from this ratio analysis. They are parts of a whole pattern of information that we build up about the risk of a company. So, for example, in ratio analysis, you will see one that I had up there called times interest earned. Times interest earned. It's actually a measure of risk. Times interest earned. And the formula for that is the dollar interest line on the finance, on the income statement, divided by the line just above it, earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT, which is also called operating income. Oh, I'm just testing your ass. You're right. See, I wanted to see if you were looking at that. EBIT. That's good. I wanted to see if you were looking, and you the hell with it. Thank you, twit. And it is not a percentage. It is actually the symbol that goes beside it is a time symbol, because it is a factor. And if I were to look here, see if I got interest expense, 447, operating income. Okay, so I would have 2411 over 447. This is for Macy's for 2011 over 447. I can't even remember long enough to bat. Okay, now if I do that, 2411 over 447, I'll get, oops. 2411 divided by 447, and I get 5.39. And again, always remember two decimal places. 5.39. And the symbol that goes beside that is an X, a time symbol. In other words, the money that is available to pay the interest can pay that interest a little more than five times over. Now, that is important that that number be above 1. Because if that number is below 1, that means you don't have enough money to pay the interest. And remember what I said, the interest is what you pay to the bondholders, to the debt holders. And if you don't pay them their money, do you remember what I said happens if you don't pay them their money? They shoot your dog, they sell your Bible on Craigslist, and they make your mama wear furry costumes that please them. Mrs. Fox, I told you, great starter kit. You want that to be above 1. Because if it's below 1, you are in default. The bondholders swoop in, they kick your butt out on the street, and they take over. You have to file for protection from that under bankruptcy code, corporate bankruptcy code. So that number has to be above 1. However, so this in itself is a measure of risk. The closer it is to 1, the riskier the company is, because it is getting perilously close to that point where it's out of business. You as the shareholders are gone. You're dead. However, so that means that the farther away from 1 it is, the better it is? No. The reality of it is that debt, what you might have heard, neither a borrower nor a lender be, debt is evil, let's get all our debt paid off. That's not true. Debt is part of, is an important component of an optimal capital structure. In other words, how much of your company is owner, how much of it comes money from the owners versus how much of it comes from lenders. You don't really want to be a company that has no debt. Although there are some very big companies out there that don't have any debt, generally speaking, we know that using debt has advantage. Essentially, it boils down to OPM. Do you know what OPM is? Do you? Okay. You might. I don't. You know what OPM is? It's other people's money. Yeah. Yeah, come on. If you have a choice of using your money or your friends, use your friends. You know? I mean, duh. Yeah. You see, if that times interest earned is too far from 1, the company is not setting itself up in such a way that it can realize what we call the gains to leverage. And I'll show you what that means in a little while. It'll be in the next lecture. But gains to leverage is simply that if you are an owner and you use debt to finance most of what you're doing, or at least part of what you're doing, you are gaining a lot in return on your investment as the owner from the debt that you are using as part of your financing deal. So the point there being that times interest earned is a metric of risk in a company. Closer to 1, the riskier. The farther from 1, well, that's nice, but I don't want it to be like 23, 50, 50 times over you could pay your interest, an infinite number of times over you could pay your interest because there isn't any interest expense. I really don't want that either. I want something that is in a balanced range, and I would look at the industry's average, and I would think about, okay, what is this company relative to its industry in terms of times interest earned? There are other metrics of risk in the ratios as well, and I could go through those kinds of metrics and talk about them, but one that I want to bring up right now. Now, obviously, the current quick and burn ratios are somewhat also measures of risk of the company, too. Like if the current ratio is below 1, that means your current liabilities cannot cover your current assets can't cover your current liabilities. That might be a measure of, that might indicate some risk in the company right there. One that I'm going to talk about right now is what is called the price to earnings ratio, or price earnings, or PDE ratio, or PE ratio. There's all kinds of ways you can hear it said. But it is this. It is nothing but the price, the current price per share divided by the earnings per share. And you want to use the earnings that are the most recent. So actually, technically, you'd want to go to a Q, the most recent Q. If the K wasn't the most recent filing of its kind, you'd want to look at the latest Q for this. But essentially, what this does, price per share divided by earnings per share. Oh, well, let's do it here for Macy's. What was my EPS? You know, I'm actually almost hurling looking at that. Net income per share is $2.92. Okay, so we got the $2.92 denominator. Now let's go over here and let's find the price. That you're not going to find, well, you'd find an old price, but let's find the current price of Macy's. And in order to do that, where the hell did I put my glasses? Oh, there they are. Okay. In order to do that, let's have a gander at something. I don't know. I'm just going to use some trashy service here. Oops. Finance.yahoo.com. And I'm going to enter the symbol for Macy's, M. There we go. Macy's. The current price is $37.81. $37.81. Okay. So now the price to earnings ratio is going to be 37.81 divided by 292. 37.81 divided by $2.92. Remember, they both have to be in per share. $12.95. And this is a times as well, because the units cancel. It's going to be just a pure fact. Now, here's what this means. It tells you how many times over, how many dollars you would pay, the market is right now paying for the claim on each dollar of net income the company generated. Again, this is telling you what the market is paying for each dollar the company just finished earning. In this case, the market is paying $12.95 for each dollar the company earned at the end of its last year. It's a multiple. The higher this number is, the riskier, in general, the company is. The lower it is, the less risky it is. Essentially, in this case, we're saying, okay, markets right now are paying maybe about $13 to claim $1 of the company. That's about what it is. Back in a long time ago, back in the Neolithic period, when I was doing this kind of stuff actively, that would have been a high PE ratio. That would have been pretty high. We like to see them 6, 8. Yeah, that's a little bit frisky there, getting up to 10. 13, that's a little scary. Now, you don't even break a sweat unless you get a PE at 40, 50. There, in the Japanese stock market, the Nikkei, before it went to hell, you had price earnings ratios of companies that were 10,000, 50,000. $50,000 paid for $1 that the company had just earned. That's insane. But still, even to this day, you're talking, it's relative risk. I would know that this PE ratio is definitely telling me that Macy's is a less risky company than, say, some company that has a PE ratio of 25. It's also probably a little more risky than a company that have a PE ratio of 8 or 9. It is a message to you as an investor one of many, about the risk of the company. I'm going to show you on this quotation here a few other things. But first, I'm going to go forward. Let me find another company here. Let's see what Google's price-earnings ratio is. 22. In other words, in the market right now is paying $22.22 for the claim of a dollar of residual earnings that are available to shareholders. Try another one. Apple. Price earnings, 16.24. You're getting kind of a little picture of these price earnings ratios. Let's try something like Halliburton. The big stable companies, not a whole lot of risk in them. Investors are paying more than a few bucks for each dollar of claim on shareholder earnings available to shareholders. But let's try, what am I thinking here? Dell. Costco. Oh, hey, hello. Well, that certainly does move your diaper around a little bit. The hell was that? That's interesting. Now, let's talk Costco. Now, let me go over to Walmart just to see. Just out of curiosity. Walmart, lower. So you see you can get kind of like a quick, dirty, relative metric of risk of different companies, even in the same industry. Let me go over, let me get JCPenney. Oh, let me get that. No, I know what I'll do. Oops. Oops, that wasn't what I wanted. There we go. Ha! So why would the price-earnings ratio be not applicable? They've lost money, and so they won't report it. Let's go to one more here, JCPenney. Straight equity. Nope. Losing money, so you can't get one for them. So it's not going to help you out with companies that are losing money. That's just, like I said, it's just one of those measures. There are a lot of those metrics out there. Let me come back to Macy's real quick here. I just want to show you something real quick here with Macy's. Notice that you can get some nice information off this, pretty current information. They try to keep it right to the queue and all that kind of stuff. Your dividend, by the way, the yield is the dividend per share divided by the current price per share. That's different from the dividend ratio, which is dividend per share divided by earnings per share. The dividend yield, this number, is how much the dividend per share divided by the current price. Another measure, which we will talk about extensively in a couple of lectures, is beta. Beta of one is the risk of the market portfolio. So this Macy's is virtually, at least in terms of its non-diversifiable risk, not its overall risk, but in terms of its non-diversifiable risk, it is virtually like a mirror image of the market itself, which, to a certain extent, that makes sense with this one. But beta is a useful measure too. Market cap. You need to write this down. Market cap is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. the price per share times the number of shares outstanding. In other words, it is the market's assessment of the actual value of that company. The price per share times the number of shares outstanding. So let us look now at the market cap of, let's say, for example, Microsoft. Let's look at the market cap. $258 billion. That is the market's objective assessment of the value of that behemoth of a company. It's $254 billion. In other words, basically, most of the value of the planet Earth itself and regions nearby that have good real estate holding potential. Let's look at Google. Market cap of Google, $245 billion is the value of that. What else is huge? Huh? Apple? Let's see Apple. $647 billion? Okay. Now, let me give you some perspective. What is your ass worth? Now, we as individuals, even everyone together in this class, ain't a fart in a hurricane compared to these, the value of these things. These are beyond comprehension. They are larger. Essentially, these companies, maybe the top 10, would be on the scale of more of virtually every nation on Earth, their value is. That gives you a sense of what you are in here, folks. You know, the average person out there who works construction or does some valuable work in his or her life, like, you know, being a waiter at Denny's, you know, this is something that it's like a universe they would never even imagine. In business, as time goes on, and this is, of course, where we begin this, sort of, is to show you the enormity of these animals that we are going, that you are going to lead someday, God help us. You are going to be the captains of industry. We're prepping you, assuming you are going to take command of big companies, industrial monsters. And so, here's an idea. Get your cowboy hat on. Make sure your leather straps are pretty tight, because those are the kinds of beasts that you are going to be a part of, and at some point, to some extent at least, directing into the future. And that should scare the hell out of you. That thing is just beyond, that's staggering. The gross domestic product of almost every country in the world is less than that. Less than that. So there you go. And also, don't have any idea that you're going to affect the stock price by recommending a buy or sell on it. Where am I? Notice, interestingly enough, Apple, it's beta. And I'm exposing you to beta now before I even talk about it formally. Its beta is 0.88. That is a little more than a little bit less than 1. What that's telling you, in a nutshell, is that in terms of non-diversifiable risk, which I'll talk about in just a few minutes, in terms of the non-diversifiable risk, this stock has 88% of the non-diversifiable risk of a very broad market portfolio, 88%. So in other words, this is a little bit on, for a more conservative investor, this would be actually a stock that you would reach for. The idea of Apple as some innovative, dynamic company that hipsters would get involved in after they've eaten macaroni and cheese because it's not mainstream, it's that's not true. This is actually a relatively conservative investment in a broad-based portfolio. On the other hand, let's try something like ADM. That's actually a little company, comparatively speaking, even less risky. These big animals like this, generally, as long as they're not in some financial trouble of some kind, they are relatively safe, and I strongly emphasize the term relatively safe companies. They're so big that it's very unlikely that anything dramatic is going to happen to them. On the other hand, the fact that very little can happen to them that's dramatic means that they are not going to be those long bomb, big win on your investment kinds of companies, generally speaking. And that is bear with me here one moment while I kill this off. And that is what takes us to the heart of today's lecture. As I told you, we can measure risk in a lot of different ways, both in our own lives and in terms of finance. Here was one right here, price-earnings ratio. It's a cheap, dirty, quick measure of risk. It's one more like, I can't really say this. For the most part, interestingly enough, in terms of investment patterns, American investors are actually less risk-averse than European investors. So you would see, and this is sort of a very loose rule of thumb, you would see European investors more likely to go for debt investments like bonds because those pay off before stock. That means that they're a less risky investment. You'll see American investors more interested in equities than in bonds. Right now, equities are really big in the American investment community. Bonds have gotten a really bad name because they don't yield worth crap right now. There are different preference structures for different people. There is no optimal risk pattern. In other words, I could see you look like a very stable, conservative person. Your investments would include possibly sacks of flour to make your own bread in the zombie apocalypse. You, on the other hand, look like just an absolute madman, a maniac. You probably dye your hair orange and go to Batman movies. Okay? Too soon? Yes, it was. I'm going to hell. But the point there being that you have to decide your own risk level. Interestingly enough, when you get older, you're going to get less and less interested in risk. You just will. I mean, your idea of risk is trying a new kind of whole grain cereal. You know that it might make you stay on the toilet for 5 hours, but hey, it has fruit and fiber. When you're younger, you will tend to be more willing to take risk. One reason for that is simply the fact that you would have more time to recover from something that a serious hit. Risk is going to put you in the position to possibly get a better return, but it's also going to put you in the position to get what we call technically in finance an ass beating. Okay? So there you go. You're going to have a trade-off. Younger investors are going to be somewhat more willing to take that trade-off than older investors will. However, the experience we have is that no one is insane with investing. They might be misinformed, but they're not crazy. Here's the thing. There are two sources of risk. There are two components to risk.
There is what is called diversifiable risk. And there is another component of risk, non-diversifiable risk. The alternate names for these, which seem kind of actually bass-ackwards, diversifiable risk is what is called non-systematic risk. Non-diversifiable risk is called systematic. It's in the system. You can't get rid of it. You can't get rid of it. The fact of the matter is that non-diversifiable risk you can remove. Risk is the sum of these two pieces. Markets don't reward you for what you don't have to bear. Markets don't pay you for stupid. Okay, notwithstanding the Jackass movies. But markets don't pay for foolishness. They will clean your clock and leave your carcass by the side of the road for hobos to remove your clothes from. The diversifiable risk is a major part of risk of a stock. You buy a single stock, you are bearing a mass of risk for which only a small part might possibly give you a reward, and there it's no guarantee. The bulk of the volatility, price volatility in a stock, and volatility is a metric of risk, that's, you can get rid of that. Let me explain the idea to you, and I'll take this away from finance, and I'll put it into insurance. I'm going to describe your life right here on the board for everyone to see from the time you were born in terms of healthcare costs. And by like expenditures. We're going to draw a timeline. So here we go. You were born. It was not a pretty birth. You had a few problems. You know, back in my time, we would put you out on the rocks, but these days, you know, every life is precious, whatever. Kind of a sickly kid. There were some diseases and illnesses, and that tail they had to cut off, but... And then you got kind of healthy, but then you had, of course, the usual little kid diseases. It created spikes. Mom and Dad had to take you in for, you know, the cholera you got because they tried to leave you out and you survived, but you had diarrhea. And you get into your terrible twos and you break your toe and then you break your ass. And then you get the childhood illnesses, some influenzas, you vomit your guts out. And then you get to a few years where you're pretty calm and stable. And then you get a car and a skateboard. And a girlfriend. And then you get into that healthier period where you people are now. You're getting into that kind of period. Do you remember when you were a kid, you vomited your guts out? There were times when you had, you know, what came out of your butt was just like fluid flowing. And then all of a sudden now, you're feeling like you don't get the colds and the flus as much. You're beginning to develop the herd immunities that we have. And you're healthy. Well, some of you are. If you lay off the cheeseburgers, you know, you'd be healthier. But you're in your healthy, strongest years. You don't think about mortality. You don't think about illnesses like cancer. You're in your healthy phase, and you don't have many problems. Now, though, you begin to get past about 28. Your hairline is receding. Your stomach is beginning to come out. You don't care. You look at yourself in the mirror and say, well, if it's good enough for the ladies, it's good enough for me. You keep telling yourself you're 3 sit-ups away from dates with supermodels. You're eating excessively at the all-you-can-eat diner, and it begins to show. Start showing. A little bit of cholesterol. You got to go in and have medicines for that. And then you have a couple of sports injuries. You actually try to do some sports, and you find out that you tear up some ligaments and some things like that. Then diabetes sets in. You have your first heart attack. You get past that. And then you have a divorce, which makes you feel better. And then you get a younger girlfriend, and that really tears it up. And then your prostate gets big. And then you start having diabetes really hit you. Into your 60s, you're starting to need more heart medications. And they put some tubes in your kidneys so you don't pee yourself. And then you're on medicines like, you know, and you try to buy Viagra, but the Viagra doesn't work. And you get into your 80s, you're a bunch of tubes connected to a bed. And then you die. Makes you feel good all over, doesn't it? Okay, now we're going to take you, woman. We're going to measure your life. Now, you were born, let's say, about a year after this gentleman. So you pick up into the stream. You were healthier in the early years, but then you had that weird nodule on your face, so they had to cut that off. And then there was that little accident with My Little Pony. And then you got into the ice cream truck with that fellow. You get in your teen years. You're actually very conservative. Most females tend not to be as stupid as males in their early years, although that's changing now, interestingly. And you're cruising along. You try to stay active and healthy. You stay slender. But you get old enough. Interestingly enough, you see, 100 years ago, we didn't have the diseases we have now because people died before those kinds of diseases showed up. Breast cancer. Another kind of cancer. High blood pressure. Cholesterol. You live much longer than he does, which really pisses me off, you know. But you die too. Now let's imagine that we do this over and over again. Notice that their costs are not perfectly correlated. That's the key. They don't have to be perfectly uncorrelated. All they have to do is be imperfectly correlated. Because essentially your ups and downs and his ups and downs are slightly canceling each other out. You see. Ultimately, if we put thousands and thousands of people together and of different ages, so we've got high costs of old people out here in their late years, they're counterbalancing the lower costs of the younger people in their earlier years. And then we got kids being born and in their healthy years counterbalancing the costs of the older people. And you get this across many people of many different ages, and something amazing happens within maybe 5,000 people, 10,000. What you see is that the cancellation of the ups and downs becomes so intense that the overall cost becomes a hum, a whisper of an underlying risk that is not part of the risk of each of the individuals. It is not a zero. There's always going to be a cost, but some people are going to be having low costs while other people are going to be having high costs. And ultimately, actuarial premium calculation is based upon this understanding of the benefits of risk pooling. And that's what we're talking about here, is pooling risk. It does not make risk go away. It levels it out so that ultimately over a large population, each of whose components has volatility, the net volatility of the system as a whole, the systematic risk, is much lower and more predictable. That is the basis of stock investing. You see, because if you buy one stock, the price volatility is going to make your head fall off. And there is not one market in the world that's going to give you a reward for bearing most of that. Because all you would have to have done is bought a bunch of stocks, and what you would have done, gotten there, is the benefit of that risk pooling effect. As you buy more stocks into a portfolio, and I'll put on the horizontal axis number of stocks, as long as they're not perfectly correlated with each other, the risk of one stock is stupidly high. The risk of two is a little lower. Three lower. What happens is that as you diversify the portfolio, the risk falls off to the point where you have the underlying hum of risk of a market portfolio. Now, a market portfolio, theoretically, would be every stock of the economy, and in your portfolio, it would have a percentage weight that reflected the weight of the market cap of that company. So like if Microsoft has 12% of the market cap of the entire economy, you would have 12% Microsoft in there, something like that. But you diversify, and ultimately that is the systematic, non-diversifiable risk. You buy one stock, two stocks, you're as stupid as hell. You hear these investors, I bought one stock, I heard an investment on it, and I bought that stock, and I made me $1 million. Well, you know what? That guy is the exception. There were probably 10 million idiots like him who got their asses beaten off by doing that. Diversify, and then it will go away. Now, what constitutes, obviously, you can't buy the market. Well, actually, you can almost these days through what are called ETFs. But if you were to buy your own stocks, how many would it take to shake out most of the diversifiable risk? It's actually not a big number. It's about 30. About 30. And that would be enough to shake out probably about 95% of the diversifiable risk. And all you'd be left with is bearing the hum of the systematic risk. And that's the risk for which you would expect a reward. You're not necessarily going to get it, but you're going to have a much better chance. Now, you have to keep an eye on it. The truth be told, that you put together a portfolio of, let's say, 50 stocks, you're going to want to keep an eye on to make sure that the portfolio is balanced. In other words, that it's still reflecting something like a miniature version of the market portfolio. You're going to have to do that. But you're not going to have to sweat and look at stock charts and all that kind of stuff every blessed day. You just keep an eye on it every now and then. And if there is going to be a downstroke in the market, most of the time, it's better to just ride it. Ride it down and then ride it back up, you see. Because basically, what are you going to do? You're going to sell out your portfolio. You're going to try to rebalance in a flurry against a market that's on a hurricane downstroke. Try to find bargains. Try to buy in. Don't. Just let it ride. It will come back. We came back from the massive downstroke that happened in 08 and 09, and the stock market hit new highs recently. But if you had pissed your pants and sold out, you would have sold out at the bottom of the market, which means that what you would have sold out for would have been pennies. Buying back in when the market had upstroked to where it is now, you'd be nowhere near where you would have been if you had just ridden the dog down to the creek. okay? Just do it that way. The whole idea of people who offer you investment advice, buy this stock, buy that stock, don't listen to it. Here's the thing, though. How do you diversify? The problem here is that if you were to buy like 30 stocks on your own, it's going to be costly to you because you're going to pay transactions fees on every purchase. And in fact, if every time you rebalanced on it, you're going to pay a transactions fee on every stock that you have to rebalance in the portfolio. So you're going to eat up some of your gains doing that kind of stuff. It's better if you want to diversify your portfolio. There are a couple of different ways that you can do it that are smart, that save you transactions fees, in some cases save you all your transactions fees. You want a diversified portfolio. You select a beta, okay, a risk. Okay, I want to take more risk than if I had the market portfolio. Or you'd say, oh, I want to have less risk than the market portfolio. Or you might even say to yourself, I want to invest only in stocks that are with companies that are green. Or I want to invest only in companies that respect workers' rights around the world. You can do all of these things, okay? First way you can do it is through mutual funds. Mutual funds essentially buy broad portfolios of stocks, and they create different types of funds within a family for different, maybe you want to go tech, maybe you want to go services. They'll give you options for all kinds of different things, all kinds of different risks, all kinds of different industries. You buy into the mutual fund, and then you have essentially bought a unit of the mutual fund. You've bought a unit of a highly diversified portfolio. And you can choose your risk. The disclosures about the beta are right there of each fund. So you can do it that way. Here's the downside of that. Mutual funds, general, almost always, there are no load and then there are low load. You can get into a no-load fund where getting in, there's no cost. Shifting your portfolio, no cost. The problem is that mutual funds, basically, you have only a few times a year when you can shift, rebalance, get out, move to another place. So you don't have the flexibility. You have the diversification. You have very low transactions costs. Even with a low load, the transactions costs are not bad. But at the same time, you don't have a lot of flexibility. Like, for example, you're going to get divorced when you're about 30. You know, you're going to want to shift your portfolio. Like, you'll have one. She'll take it all. But, you know, you'll have a few scraps left. You want to shift it into something else? If you're not in the window, you can't do it. You're not allowed to. You'll have to just sit there. You suddenly have looked in the mirror one day, and you're 50 years old. God! The first thing you say to yourself is, I've got to rebalance my portfolio for retirement and also get a membership in AARP. Yes, and you'll have to do all those things. Someday you'll have to rebalance. Suppose that the day that it hits you is a day you can't rebalance in the mutual, you can't shift in the mutual fund. Okay, now that's a little bit overstating. Most people really shouldn't be shifting that much. Four times a year should be plenty. But some people like to have more flexibility than that. Their lives are a little bit more volatile and such things as that. Okay, now there's another way that you can get market diversification without buying 30, 50, 100 shares of different stocks. You can go with what are called ETFs. And I'll expect you to find out what ETF stands for. Here's what's cool about ETFs. They trade like stocks. You buy a share of an ETF. But that ETF, what you're buying, is actually a portfolio. You could buy an ETF that was the Standard & Poor's 500. That's a hell of a diversified portfolio. It's balanced. Each stock in this ETF's portfolio is in the company's capital market cap. proportional to the economy. These are professionals. They're balancing it all the time. Any dividends that are paid, they plow them back in. They reinvest them back into the ETF. Or they might pay them out as dividends to you, just like stock. It's just like having a stock. And the cool thing is that you can call your broker. You don't have to join a mutual fund. You just call your broker and buy 100 shares of an ETF. You choose one that is consistent with your risk preferences and all of that. But, of course, the downside of an ETF is that just like stock, you're going to pay a transaction fee every time you do a trade. So it's one of those, you know, take your choice. Mutual funds, no or very low transactions fees, but you have limited opportunities to alter your portfolio. ETFs, you can call day or night, buy more in the ETF, sell off, move to another ETF, whatever you want to do, but you pay just like you were buying and selling stock. So you've got the higher transactions fee. What would you do? I'm curious. What would you do? Which would sound better to you, a mutual fund or an ETF for someone like you? Yeah. Mutual fund? What would you say? Is mutual fund sound better or an ETF sound better? Mutual fund? Well, here's the interesting thing. ETFs are actually, and this is just anecdotal, ETFs are actually more preferred by younger investors because they like that feel of control they have with something that they can take care of moving it if they want to at any time. Mutual funds are much more likely to be popular with institutional investors, older investors, more established things like trust funds and all of that. Essentially, the kinds of investors that don't want to be actively involved in their portfolio. They just want some place where they can get the benefits of diversification and without the transactions cost, and they don't have to worry about it. It's just there. ETFs are for more people and institutions that want dynamic control. They also, especially in times when you're concerned about which way the economy is going, maybe an ETF would be a little bit more preferable. Think about it like this. I'm not sure that there's going to be a bad downstroke in the economy, but I've put the probability just up high enough that I'm keeping an eye. I'm a little worried. I'm not going to jump, I'm not going to have a heart attack right away, but I'm worried. I would probably, in a situation like that, be more interested in ETFs. So one morning when I opened the door and there were a bunch of zombies standing there and they were saying, have you ever talked to a Jehovah's Witness, something like that, and I'd shut the door, I could trade right away. If I felt more confident about the economy, I'd probably be less likely to go ETF. I'd be more, well, I'm not going to need to do anything quick on a trade to rebalance, to move to a lower risk or something like that. I'd probably be mutual fund oriented. Right now, for example, I'm putting the probability of a secondary recession very low. We're going to have a very sluggish period of growth in both the global economy and in the U.S. economy, although the U.S. economy will pick up in the first and second quarter. I don't see a recession anywhere near. I don't see spectacular explosive growth. That's mutual fund territory. I don't need the flexibility of being able to trade fast. You see the difference? This is just so that you can know what we do in finance and what you know from this class about your own investment preferences. Diversifiable risk and non-diversifiable risk. You will see stocks that have really wild up and downs on their price, a lot of risk. Volatility, price volatility is a measure of risk. Know this, some of those stocks could actually be very low beta stocks. The wild up and down swing is almost perfectly correlated uncorrelated with the market portfolio. So all you're seeing is a kind of risk that you shouldn't expect reward for. Now, early in the course, I gave you a rule of finance, and now I have to give you the more exact rule. The basic rule is that the greater the risk, the greater the return you should expect. The greater the risk, the greater the return you should expect. If you're going to jump off a building for me, you expect a good payment for it, $2. $1 is just not going to be enough. You expect a better return. If you are going to drive like a blind trout, you expect a reward. You're going to get to your destination sooner. You're bearing a risk. Now, that doesn't mean you will get to your destination sooner, because some cop might stop you. And then you've blown. Your risk was not rewarded. So again, this is expectation of reward. It's not actual reward. Okay? So know that when I say expected return, just because you take a risk does not mean you will get rewarded. You take the risk because you expect to be rewarded. So now I've told you, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. But as of this lecture, it's not that. It's the greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk that you can't get rid of, the greater the expected return. In other words, don't expect a reward for bearing risk that you didn't have to bear. Don't expect a reward that's substantial for taking on and buying one stock, because most of that risk is risk you did not have to take. And you are not going to have a cold-blooded market of millions and millions of traders and literally trillions of dollars flowing every day give you a damn red cent for taking risk that you didn't have to take. That's not how it works. So the final rule is this. And on my first exam, which is coming up in just a few weeks, there will be essay questions. Every question you answer on my essay, you answer in one sentence. I promise you, and I will show it to you, I have a bullshit stamp. It's red. Don't ever go over one sentence. If I ask you for the relationship between risk and return, you write this down. The greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. In other words, when you answer questions in my class, you parrot what I've told you, because no one is going to pat you on the back for being creative, for writing an essay, for showing your feelings. We're business people. We have no feelings. We're capitalists. All we want is blood. That's all I have for you today. Thank you.